Hey folks, Micah here. We're about to get started, but before we do, I just want to remind you that you can always get show notes for this and every other episode at ChristianTransHumanistPodcast.com. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for email updates so we can let you know when new shows are released, when new things happen in the Christian transhumanist community, and most importantly, so that we can connect you with other people just like you exploring questions just like this. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the show. All right, well, I'm Micah Redding, and I'm here with Aubrey DeGray, who's a biomedical gerontologist, the founder and chief science officer of the SENS Research Foundation, editor-in-chief of Rejuvenation Research, and author of the book Ending Aging. Thanks so much, Aubrey, for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the headline and kind of work our way back. The title of the book is Ending Aging, and obviously this is kind of a headline description of what your work is and what you're doing. How did you get into this work? How did you start down this path? What led you to doing this incredibly ambitious and pretty audacious task?
Well, I guess the answer to that comes in two parts. The first question is, why do I like to dedicate myself to audacious and ambitious challenges? Mm-hmm. And that dates back to my early childhood, actually. I always was academically successful, and I knew that I was reasonably smart. But dating from, I'm going to say, the age of 9, I came to the conclusion that I really wanted to spend my life making a difference to the world. I realized that there were plenty of ways to spend one's time to become good at things that lots of other people are already good at, and to, you know, contribute almost nothing to the overall, future of humanity. And I didn't think much of that. So over time, obviously throughout my teenage years, I gradually crystallized that attitude into a decision to go into science and technology, and to avoid doing a lot of things that my friends were doing. Hmm. And the next step really was that when I started learning how to write software at the age of 15 or so, I found out I was pretty good at it, and so I decided to go into artificial intelligence research, which was something where I felt, we've got a chance of solving one of the really major problems that humanity has, namely the fact that people have to spend so much of their time doing stuff that they really wouldn't do unless they were being paid for it. And therefore we need more automation, which is what artificial intelligence is all about. Yeah. But even dating back as far as I can remember, I always knew perfectly well that this problem, the problem of, let's say, let's call it tedium, was only the world's second most serious problem. And that the world's most serious problem was the problem of aging, which doesn't just take away your time, it takes away your health, and it causes far more suffering than anything else in the world. I never really thought about going into that area myself, basically because I had never really had much enthusiasm for biology. But I had always totally assumed that people who did work as biologists agreed with me on this and were, getting on with it. And sure enough, we didn't hear much about it, but that's because it's a really difficult problem. So I never gave it any thought back then. And so that moves on to the second half of my answer, which is that when I was in my late 20s, I met and married a biologist, someone from California, actually, who was on sabbatical in England. She is a lot older than me, and she was already a full professor at the time we met in 1990. And so basically over the next couple of years, I kind of accidentally learned a lot of biology over the dinner table just by talking about her work. And gradually, I began to realize that we were never talking about aging. And I started to ask questions, and it became apparent very quickly that she wasn't interested in aging. She thought it was a rather boring and unimportant topic. And I found out that it wasn't just her, that pretty much all the other biologists I was meeting thought the same way. And I was completely blindsided. It was absolutely astonishing to me that this could be the case. And it took me a couple more years, really, to come to terms with it, really, to actually, you know, accept that this could possibly be true, because I had never, you know, it was like someone revealing to me that the sky is actually not blue at all. It's actually purple, you know. So eventually when I, you know, came to terms with it, I decided, well, I mean, there is no question. The problem I'm working on is a very important problem, but this problem is even more important. Therefore, I have no choice but to switch fields one way or another. And I happened at that point to be in a very convenient position to do that. I had taken a very undemanding bioinformatics job at the University of Cambridge that allowed me to, you know, pay the bills, but also have a lot of spare time. I had taken that job in order to be able to continue pursuing my artificial intelligence research, which I didn't have any other funding for anymore. But of course, that meant that all I had to do was repurpose my spare time and build a whole new career for myself that way. And that's what happened.
I like that. It's just all I had to do was just build a whole new career for myself. For most people, I think that would be a pretty daunting task. I mean, you pivoted a pretty big pivot into a field that, you know, I would say from my vantage point in doing software development is very different, or seems very different, seems pretty intimidating to just kind of just jump into sort of midstream.
Well, yeah, I mean, fair enough. I mean, I'm not trying to say that anyone could have done it. I know that I had brought a number of qualities, you know, not just intelligence, but also, you know, determination and so on. To this that enabled me to do it. But equally, I don't want to downplay the fact that there was a hell of a lot of luck involved. I was just in the right place at the right time.
So let's talk about your assumption that you had that biologists were working on this because it was the most important problem in the world. So you were trying to tackle the second most important problem in the world, the problem of human tedium. And I kind of want to come back to that. But the first most important problem in the world is, by your account, is the fact that humans age. So I think most people would not find that intuitive at all, right? Most people would say, well, what's the big deal, or why is this a problem to be solved? So why would you argue that this is actually the most important problem in the world?
I think the main reason why this was so obvious to me, when it's not obvious to most people, is that I was never brainwashed into thinking that there is some fundamental difference between the diseases of old age on the one hand and aging itself on the other hand. Nobody ever told me that, and it was never occurred to me that anyone might think that. That presumption is in fact complete nonsense. It has exactly no biological basis whatsoever, and yet it is a very deep-seated presumption in society, and also, I'm afraid, among biologists. And the worst of it is that this presumption is actually perpetuated and promoted by biologists. You know, this is not specific to biology by any means, but it's a terrible, you know, side effect of lack of funding and the career pressures that scientists are under, that they have to try to carve out a niche for themselves. So it is in the kind of vested interests of both the people who study biology of aging and the people who study the diseases of old age to kind of, you know, play up the idea that there's not much connection between the two. But in fact, it is viciously counterproductive to the development of medicines that actually work against the ill health of old age. Because, in fact, the only way we're going to be able to do that is by regarding the whole thing as a unit, as a network of inextricably intertwined things that can only be addressed as a whole.
So you're saying that that all of the kind of various efforts that we take on as a society to, you know, fight cancer or fight heart disease or fight these other kinds of things we experience as we get older are really being held back by not seeing them as part of just this whole complete fabric.
Absolutely, unquestionably. And in fact, now, as of literally only the past few years, there is an increasingly explicit and public acknowledgement of that fact by gerontologists, people who study the biology of aging. And this is already reaping rewards. For example, it has led very recently to an accommodation between the gerontology community and the FDA. The FDA have always been in this position of saying, well, aging is not a disease, it's not a condition we can approve drugs for. And of course, this has had an extremely chilling effect on the enthusiasm of the medical research world in the private sector to actually invest in this area. Mm-hmm. Now, a compromised definition of what aging is has been identified and promoted, which kind of, you know, does the job for both the gerontologists and the FDA. And this whole logjam is in the process of essentially disappearing, and that will be enormously valuable. But it's worse than that. This unjustified assumption of this dichotomy between the two things has also led people to go after the diseases of old age in ways that can never possibly work, because they attack those diseases rather as if those diseases were infections, you know, that could be completely eliminated from the body, which is just like astonishingly ridiculous, because, you know, it's kind of obvious to anyone who comes in from the outside, or it should be obvious, that a disease cannot be a disease of old age unless it is part of aging, unless it is some kind of initially non-symptomatic, harmless process that goes on throughout life and eventually becomes symptomatic as a result of its progression. You know, how else can something be only affecting people who were born a long time ago? So it was always so obvious to me that I didn't even realize the possibility that anyone else could miss it.
That's interesting. You're talking about the fact that this kind of definition of what aging is has been historically kind of controversial, and I think our common notion of it is fairly kind of at odds with what you're saying. But you're saying aging is a disease. Can you unpack that a little bit more? What exactly would you say is happening in the aging process?
Well, okay, let me step back a little from that, first of all. First of all, I do not say that aging is a disease.
Okay.
And the reason I don't say it is because the word disease has too much baggage around it. Diseases are, in one's mindset, they are things that can be cured, can be eliminated from the body, like infection. So I prefer to avoid that. I prefer to say aging is a medical condition. It's something which is rightly the part of the business of medicine to do something about. But I don't like to call it a disease, because that kind of biases people in the wrong direction. It's definitely something that we should and can, as medical researchers, develop ways to address and to alleviate. But I don't like to call it a disease per se. To unpack it, the way I tend to find easiest to explain this in is simply to refer to the structure of the human body. So whether or not we say that humans have a physical component and also a non-physical, you know, spiritual component like the soul or whatever, whether or not we say that, the fact is that the physical component, the body, is a machine. It's a really, really complicated machine, but it's, you know, a collection of atoms and molecules and so on that move around. You know, it's a machine with moving parts. A ridiculously complicated one, and ridiculously poorly understood, of course, because we don't have the plans, so to speak, the blueprint, but still a machine. And there's a very universal property of machines, which is that their function is determined by their structure. In other words, if we have a machine that is in a poor state of functioning, it's functioning poorly, and we restore its structure to how it was at some time in the past when it was functioning well, then we will also restore its function. So I just start from that ridiculously simple principle And I say, well, okay, what is the change that happens? What are the changes that happen in the structure of the human body during its life, during adult life in particular? And how can we, well, can we first of all describe that? Can we characterize the range of changes that occur at the molecular level and the cellular level? And then can we figure out ways to reverse that? Not to reverse the process by which the changes occur, but to restore the overall structure, basically by repairing the changes. So I just use the word damage to refer, as a one word, to the whole collection of changes that occur, in particular the changes which eventually contribute to the ill health of old age, eventually become excessive to a point where the body doesn't know what to do about them. So I call that damage. It's just about repairing that damage, putting the body back into a state that approximates how it was in early adulthood. Mm-hmm.
So what you're to kind of like play off what you said at first, like it's not exactly that aging is a disease, but it is continuous with, like, to work against aging is continuous with what medicine does, what doctors do. It's to fix damage, to repair damage, to make things work that have stopped working.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's useful to think that way, to emphasize the fact that this is just medicine. Mm-hmm. All medicine is about damage repair in one way or the other. It's just that most medicine these days, or at least most medicine that actually works, is about repairing damage that is inflicted by some kind of external agent, like an infection. Mm. And therefore, once it has been fixed, it's not going to happen again unless and until one is reinfected. Mm-hmm. The problem with aging, of course, and again, I obviously emphasize that I mean here everything that goes wrong in old age, not just the, including the things that we call age-related diseases. Mm-hmm. The problem with all that is that they are side effects of the way that the body normally works. So they are effectively self-inflicted damage that's going to happen however one lives, you know, however one avoids infections and so on.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, you know, there are different kind of theories of aging and what causes it and so forth. One theory that kind of keeps popping up is that, you know, the human body is kind of programmed, has some kind of programmed termination point or that kicks in, or some kind of process that kicks in at a certain point. Do you think that's accurate? Do you think or how would you kind of look at that?
Yeah, that's definitely complete nonsense. And furthermore, I am fortunate enough to be able to tell you that my view that it's complete nonsense is the consensus view within gerontology. Hmm. Basically, there are no prominent gerontologists who disagree with me on this. And this has been the case for a long, long time now, for at least 40 years, that everyone has understood that aging is not programmed. The reason why people initially assumed that it was kind of programmed was basically circumstantial. It was an oversimplification of something that we see. The thing that was oversimplified, or it was oversimplistically interpreted, is that lots of things go wrong with us in old age at more or less the same time. Of course, some people get cancer, some people get heart disease and so on, but they all happen at more or less the same time. And that kind of makes it look as though there's some coordination going on with some kind of central clock that drives everything. Mm-hmm. But that is, if you think about it a little bit, it's just like completely inconsistent with what we understand about how nature works, about how genes survive from one generation to the next and so on. You just wouldn't expect that there would be any machinery that would cause us to age. Because if there were, then the first of all, the machinery would be damaging the organism and diminishing its ability to have offspring. Mm-hmm. And that is contrary to how nature works. You know, nature tries to maximize the amount of offspring that we can have. But secondly, and perhaps more profoundly and more easy to get one's head around, if you think about it, the machinery that we definitely know that we do have in the body, a huge amount of it is anti-aging. it's machinery that does automatic, ongoing repair of damage that allows us to live as long as we do. So it kind of makes no sense that we would have two simultaneously active programs going on, an anti-aging program and a pro-aging program that were diametrically opposed in their functions. What would happen is that they would kind of fight each other to a standstill, and one or other of them would just kind of disappear into oblivion by virtue of mutations over time.
So you're saying it's really just a matter of time, like, you know, that time essentially is wearing us down or introducing enough problems that eventually, you know, whatever the date is for our society, 70 or 80 or 90 or 100, like, eventually most of us succumb to that.
Well, kind of. I mean, I want to kind of get away from the word time, because that kind of, you know, makes it sound as though there's absolutely nothing we can do about it. We clearly can't slow down time. So really what I think it's more accurate way of saying it is it's the activity of a machine that has moving parts, whether it's the human body or whether it's a car or whatever. It's just the process of its normal operation. So a car, you know, it goes out and drives along, and the result is that the oil in the engine gets, contaminants in it, and let's say the doors rust and so on. In the same case with the human body, you know, breathing is really bad for you. Breathing is the major reason why we create these molecules called free radicals, which inflict a bunch of damage on DNA and such like. But the fact is, breathing is rather non-negotiable. You know, we've just got to do it. So really, yeah, it's the activities rather than the time. However, what the critical thing that one always has to come back to is the consequence of the activities, the change in the molecular and cellular structure of the body, the modifications that happen at the chemical level to DNA, for example, that gradually, progressively accumulate over time. And the fact that the body, like any simple machine, is set up to tolerate a certain amount of that damage without significant impairment of performance. But eventually, it's not set up to tolerate an infinite amount, and so you've got too much damage, and the performance declines and eventually ceases entirely.
So let's talk about what this would look like if your work is successful, you begin to be able to tackle this problem in a significant way. And so suddenly, you know, something comes on the market that is this significantly effective anti-aging treatment. What does that actually look like? You know, I think a lot of people imagine maybe taking a pill that then they live forever or something like that. What's the scenario that this would actually, the way this would actually play out?
Yeah, great question. So from the point of view of the patient, the recipient, it's actually going to be pretty much indistinguishable from today's medicine. From the point of view of the developer of the medicine or the doctor who's supplying it, it may be quite different, especially it will be very much more combinatorial, you know, lots of things being done to the same person at the same time. But the only thing that will really distinguish it from today's medicine in terms of what the patient experiences is that it will predominantly be preventative. In other words, it will be applied to people who are not yet sick. And it will be applied progressively, periodically, as a prophylactic treatment that will keep the level of damage in the body down below the threshold that's problematic.
And can this be something that kind of comes online in stages, or is there going to be like the kind of, you know, one golden solution to everything? Or is this going to be more gradual progress we might see?
It will definitely come along in stages. And actually, I want to give a rather more expansive answer to that, because there are various ways in which that's true. So because we create lots and lots of different types of damage in the body as a side effect of being alive, that means that unquestionably this has to be a divide and conquer strategy. It has to be something in which we develop a wide range of different therapies to repair different types of damage, and we apply them all. Now, some of those things will be easier to develop than others. And the first piece of good news is that each of those therapies will, on its own, have substantial benefits for some people, simply because of those variations that I mentioned earlier from one person to another in the rate at which different types of damage accumulate. There's only minor differences in those rates from one person to another, at least within most of the population, but that's enough to make to give rise to the fact that some people die of cancer and some people die of heart attacks and so on. So that means we can expect to see these individual components of the whole panel being developed and tested in very much the way that medicines are developed and tested today and applied to the appropriate subpopulation. However, because it's a divide and conquer strategy and because everyone accumulates all the types of damage at similar rates, albeit not identical rates, that means that the real bang for the buck, the really big component of the ill health of old age, will only be seen when all of the components are working reasonably well. At that point, I believe that we have an opportunity to move the needle in terms of how long people can stay healthy and youthful forward by a few decades, rather than perhaps only a few years that might be achieved if we can only fix half of the types of damage, for example. So that's quite a big deal. The other answer to your question, though, which I probably ought to come to, especially given the kind of audience that you've got, is that that will not be the end of the story. The other way in which this is going to be a progressive, incremental accumulation of therapies and improvement of the effects is that so far I've only talked about what you might call version one of each of the types of damage. There are lots of different types of damage, and we've got to fix them all reasonably well in order to get, let's say, 30 years of additional healthy life. But each of those types of therapies will, at that point, still only be somewhat short of truly 100% comprehensive. And there will continue thereafter, therefore, to be further refinements, further improvements. So we'll have SENS 2.0 and SENS 3.0 as time goes on, and those therapies will come closer and closer to being 100% comprehensive. And the effect of that will be that the same people who were, let's say, 60 years old when they got the initial therapies, if they come back being, if you like, biologically 60 again at the age of chronologically 90, that will have been, you know, they'll be able to benefit from 30 years of additional research that has improved the therapies, so that even though the original therapies that they had 30 years previously won't work anymore because the damage is inherently more recalcitrant at the greater age, nevertheless, the improvements in the therapies will kind of outrun that, so that they will get improved. They will get benefits, and they won't be, you know, chronologically 60 for the third time until they're biologically 60 for the third time until they're chronologically 150, and so on. This is the concept that I've called longevity escape velocity, and what it means, of course, is that even though the therapies will never, or almost certainly never, be 100% comprehensive, nevertheless, the effect on people's health, and therefore the effect on how likely they are to die of ill health associated with old age, will be identical to what it would be if the therapies were truly 100% comprehensive from the beginning.
Well, that's interesting. And it's interesting because what that sounds like is, we get this kind of escape velocity, this ending of aging, but not by, one day kind of taking a magic pill or something like that, but rather by, as a society, we've continued to engage in this ongoing process of medical research and working to cure disease and to push back the aging process, essentially.
That's right.
So, okay, so that brings us to what I'm sure most people tend to focus on, which is like what kind of impact this has on society. And so I know like there's all kinds of questions around that. But one thing that I heard you talk about once was the difference between the kind of aging pattern of ancient hunter-gatherers, let's say, and then the aging pattern that we have in our society today, and then how this might kind of change that. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Sure. So there isn't all that much difference between the biology, the processes of aging from 10,000 years ago versus the process of aging today. The of course, the situation back thousands of years ago was that there was, in fact, even a few hundred years ago, a high rate of death from causes that had nothing to do with aging. In fact, even in the wealthiest country 100 years ago, we were still at a point where more than one third of babies would die before the age of one. And of course, you know, across the entire developed world and indeed the developing world now, that simply doesn't happen. We've got, you know, we've pretty much got on top of tuberculosis and diphtheria and so on. And of course, the same applies not only to infections, but to other sources of death, like hypothermia and starvation and so on. There's not much of that in the developed world either. And we're in a similar way, bearing down on it, not fast enough, but getting there, in the rest of the world. So, so that, of course, is why we see this epidemic of the ill health of old age, because so many people are escaping from the causes of death that would have knocked them off at a younger age, and thereby are suffering from these phenomena. They were much rarer a long time ago, but they were still happening. They were still happening at pretty much the same rate in an individual. It's just that the individual usually didn't live long enough to experience them.
So, okay, so, yeah, so the people in the ancient world, they're all aging, but they're experiencing much more graphic and distressing deaths in some sense than we're used to. We now experience these, you know, the kinds of ways that we die are primarily aging rather than the kind of ancient patterns of society. And so what does that do if we remove aging? What becomes our primary cause of death then?
Well, of course, the answer to that question cannot be given just by looking at biology. There are other causes of death today in the developed world. You know, some people do get hit by trucks. There are certain infectious diseases that we have not yet got on top of and so on. And those things will continue to be true. And, you know, Sense Research Foundation does not work on stopping people from being hit by trucks. And again, you know, we are not, we're quite happy that some people are working on that. And so we can certainly expect that all causes of death will actually diminish in their incidence over time. And we can look at other, you know, knock-on effects of the success that we will have in alleviating aging. For example, at the moment, a completely scandalously small amount of money is spent on vaccine development and on thereby the prevention and preemption of large numbers of deaths from pandemics. We've kind of got away with that by and large so far, but it's a fine line that we're walking. And I believe that we would not be doing that. We would be, you know, taking a much more responsible attitude to the risk of pandemics if we knew that there was quite a large chance that we would die of them before dying of anything else. The problem that we have at the moment in that area is that, of course, most people realize that the chances are they'll die of aging before they die of a pandemic, and therefore lower down their priority. Right, so these are the ways one has to think in order to look forward into the distant future with regard to what people will die of. And therefore, I think really the obvious thing, the obvious next step is to look at existential risks. The idea that we might kill ourselves using, you know, out of control artificial intelligence that decided that we were unimportant, or that we might get, that the planet might get hit by an asteroid, or a nearby star might blow up, or, you know, those kinds of things. And I am fairly sure that we will also put significant effort into minimizing those risks, but there's only so far one can go.
So, okay, so let's talk about what I think most people, for most people, is the kind of headline question. Is this going to lead to a divide between the rich and the poor, where rich people are living for, you know, hundreds or thousands of years and kind of an Elysium style life where everyone else is just kind of in, you know, squalor living 30 years or something like that?
Sure, that's certainly one of the major questions that do come up. The answer to my mind is very straightforward. It's this. As things stand, aging is ridiculously expensive, and I mean purely in economic terms here. Let's even put the humanitarian side to one side for the moment. Probably 90% of the medical budget of the Western world goes on aspects of ill health that are associated with old age. And that is just crazy. Plus, of course, we're not just talking about the direct costs. There's a huge indirect cost, the fact that the kids of the elderly are less economically productive because they're having to spend time and effort looking after their parents. And the fact that the elderly are unable to contribute wealth to society. All they can do is consume wealth because they're not able-bodied. Now, all of these things go away if you've got treatments for aging. And yes, the treatments themselves will cost money to generate and to deliver, but the question is, will they pay for themselves? Not at the level of the individual, I'm talking at the level of an economy, a country, shall we say. Hmm. And the answer is, any way you look at it, these things are going to pay for themselves massively many times over, very quickly indeed. Hmm. So from the point of view of a government, it's just completely obvious that it would be economically suicidal not to supply these therapies, irrespective of ability to pay, to everybody who's old enough to need them. Hmm. Now, I appreciate that there are a number of reasons why this kind of logic is counterintuitive and hard to accept, especially perhaps in the USA, which, of course, is a very tax-averse country as compared to the one that I came from. But still, the logic is absolutely clear. What we must not do is presume that we can assume that today's high-tech medicine constitutes a valid precedent. The reason it doesn't constitute a valid precedent is very straightforward. Today's medicine, as I mentioned, is overwhelmingly spent on the ill health of old age, and none of it works. Hmm. We've got therapies that very modestly, if at all, postpone the ill health of old age. It costs a hell of a lot of money. And then the people get sick anyway, and we have to spend the same money and the same economic costs that we would have had if we hadn't spent the medicine. So the economic arithmetic for such medicine is basically very negative. Hmm. It basically means that there's no way that one can argue that these medicines pay for themselves. They do exactly the opposite. Therefore, one must not use that as a precedent. The only really valid precedent that I think exists in today's society is basic education. That, you know, if you, basic education is free for everybody, even in the USA. And the fundamental reason it is because if you don't have some kind of literacy and numeracy and general basic education in your population, you're going to be uncompetitive internationally. And so the country will go bankrupt. That is the fundamental reason why basic education is free everywhere. And that actually is very much the same logic for why these medicines will be free everywhere for anyone who's old enough to need them, even if people are not just voting for them. Hmm. I think it's what's going to happen.
So that's interesting. Anti-aging medicine will be like education in terms of society, and that implies that, as you've stated, that the cost of the anti-aging medicine will be low enough that it won't be like $50 million per person or something like that, where it couldn't be ever funded. It will be low enough to where it becomes very economically feasible to fund for everyone.
Sure. I mean, it could easily be $50,000 per person per year, but mm-hmm. that would be a tiny fraction of the amount that would be saved.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so all right, so richer versus poor, I think, is a big thing that comes up for me anyway, or in conversations that I have. Another one is kind of the idea of overpopulation and, you know, just taking up space. Do the old people need to kind of make way for the young or something like that? What's your take on that?
Well, the first thing I want to say is you're absolutely right that concern is raised, perhaps even more frequently than the concern about inequality of access. And the thing that depresses me the most about the whole business is that the same people will so often raise both of those objections in consecutive breaths, even though they are obviously mutually exclusive. You know, you can't have overpopulation if only a small minority of people are getting the therapy.
Right.
But anyway, so yeah. I mean, there are a variety of answers to this. And actually, what I want to say is that it's an area in which the proponents and the supporters of this mission are sometimes disappointing to me, because they often don't actually focus on giving the most persuasive and most effective and most true answers to this question. A lot of people tend to say, oh, it won't be a problem, we will emigrate into space in large numbers. And there are plenty of reasons why that's a stupid answer. It's first of all, it actually wouldn't work. We would run out. We would not be able to get to enough space in enough time. I can talk about that later if you want. But also, you know, people don't want to go to space, and it's kind of not persuasive. So I think it's very important to, you know, to actually put oneself in the position of the person who's asking the question whenever one is in these conversations. All right, so what are the answers to this question? Well, there are a couple of answers which are a bit controversial, but nevertheless probably true. And they involve fertility. The fact is that with virtually no exception across the whole of society, across the whole of history, I think the only exception I'm aware of is Israel, actually. Every society that has reached a certain level of prosperity and female education and emancipation and so on has transitioned very rapidly to a level of very much lower fertility rates, the number of kids that the average woman has. And of course, one presumes that different women in different societies have different reasons for that, you know, whether it's like, you know, there are just other things they want to do before they get on with this very time-consuming thing, you know, stuff like that. But of course, it's also about the survival rate. People may have had a lot of kids in the past because a lot of those kids would die before they could get to be old enough to look after their parents, and so on. But anyway, the fact is this happens. And it is the reason why the United Nations projects that sometime this century, the total population of the planet will actually peak and start to decline. Because so many countries, especially the larger countries, are in that demographic transition phase right now. And their fertility rates are going through the floor. The other thing that's important to take into account is the average age at which women have their kids. So I just mentioned, like, you know, maybe women have fewer kids because they've got other things to do. They also have their kids later as a result of, you know, having greater opportunity in life. And this always goes in lockstep with the reduction in overall number of kids. So, of course, then we have to ask the question, how is that trend going to progress in the future? And today, we see only a relatively small change, a few years, in the average age at which women have kids. But a large part of the reason for that, surely, is because there's a deadline. There's this thing called menopause, which means that if you want kids ever, you'd better have them before the age of 40. And this, of course, is something that is going to go away, along with all the other aspects of aging. Women are going to be able to have kids safely, you know, without any health risks or anything, at any age that they want. So the immediate reaction to that, of course, is, oh dear, that's going to make the overpopulation problem even riskier, even worse, because women are going to carry on having more and more kids over their indefinite lifespans. But actually, that's the wrong way to think about it. The right way to think about it is this is an opportunity for women to continue to delay having their first kid and their second kid by another decade and another decade in order to, you know, do other stuff first. So my projection, certainly, and I'm not the only one who says this, is that actually the elimination of menopause will have a dampening effect on the trajectory of global population. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
So those are the two things that I used to historically emphasize as the main reasons. But now actually there's another one which I have found to be a good deal more persuasive. And so I definitely want to emphasize it before we move on.
Okay.
And that is other technologies. When we talk about overpopulation, what we actually talk about is overpollution. Not having too many people, but having too many people who cumulatively do too much damage to the planet. So if we can reduce the number of, the amount of damage that an individual does to the planet on average, then of course we increase the carrying capacity of the planet. We allow more people to exist. And if we look at the major ways in which we do damage the planet right now, we are on the cusp of being on top of them, whether it's carbon, climate change as a result of fossil fuels. Renewable energy is overtaking. It's becoming cheaper, and it's going to be the answer. And if we look at agriculture, artificial meat and such like, hamburgers made in the lab are going to taste as good as hamburgers that are made in a cow. And as a result, we're going to be polluting a lot less. And we can talk about many other technologies that are relevant to this. Desalination, for example. All of these things are going to make a huge impact on the polluting power of the population before therapies that really bring aging under control even arrive. That, I believe, is the major answer to the concern about having too many people.
Yeah, that's good. And there's almost a correspondence between this fight to kind of stop the damage or repair the damage that is happening in our bodies, and to also stop and repair the damage that is happening in the world at large.
I absolutely agree. A very good correspondence.
Yeah, so that's interesting. The other thing that just kind of stuck out to me is that if the population is peaking this century, as you pointed out, like that's the estimate, then we could, and I'm not sure what the estimates look like after that, but I'm wondering if there is a population decline that we ultimately could potentially head off by basically bringing online the anti-aging technologies, that maybe we need to do that if we want to kind of keep our society running and functional.
Absolutely. I mean, of course, we're already seeing that kind of logic applying in certain countries that have particularly low fertility rates and particularly low immigration. I think that, we're going to need to see a good deal more flexibility in terms of migration from one country and one part of the world to another in order to even things out, even in the short term. And yes, certainly going forward, that what you say is true.
Okay, so one more objection that I've heard, and that is relative to the idea of kind of new ideas or new blood. Is it necessary to essentially kind of get rid of, say, one generation of people in order for humanity to progress? A lot of times people talk about the scientific, the structure of scientific revolutions. We need to kind of shuffle off the older generation of scientists, or things like that. So do you buy into that? Like, do we need to have this process of aging and death in order to kind of keep rejuvenating society?
So it won't surprise you to learn that no, I don't buy into it. But I want to go further than that. So unlike the other two concerns that we've addressed already, I want to tell you that this concern comes into a group that I regard as kind of that I tend to be less diplomatic and less polite about. My view of concerns like that is, get a grip, grow up. The issue really is sense of proportion. We all know that aging causes the most astronomical amount of suffering, and I do not tend to meet people who want to get Alzheimer's disease or cancer or whatever. I don't tend to meet people who want anyone else to get Alzheimer's disease or whatever. And yet, people with a straight face will say things like, oh dear, how will we enable turnover, or how will we, won't it be terribly boring, and so on. A friend of mine, Brian Kennedy, was on stage with me a few months ago, and he was asked this question, and he put it very succinctly, so it stuck in my mind. He said, well, if I've got the choice between being bored at the age of 150 or getting Alzheimer's at the age of 80, I think I know which one I'm going to choose. And, I mean, this is the point. Sense of proportion, boys and girls. It's just a matter of remembering the severity of the problem. So one has to ask oneself, why will otherwise perfectly intelligent people make such egregious errors of judgment in this regard? And my view is it's very straightforward. It's purely psychological. We have had no choice since the dawn of civilization other than to find some way to put this ghastly phenomenon out of our minds and get on with our miserably short lives and make the best of them rather than being preoccupied by this terrible thing. And the only way we've been able to do it is by developing this habit of coming up with excuses for aging and reasons why it might be a blessing in disguise, and then instantly switching off our brains before we realize that we're talking complete nonsense. You know, it's not very good, really. And it's not very, it's childish, as far as I'm concerned. It's ridiculously irresponsible.
Yeah, when you put it that way, pretty callous, in fact, right? That these are the kinds of concerns. And historically, it feels like these are the kinds of concerns that are raised by people who don't have a very high view of human life itself.
I think that's right.
Yeah. So, okay. So, yeah. So those are the big kinds of questions that I hear in terms of, kind of most mainstream concern. So I'm wondering what you see as, happening, at, 150 and so on. As you said, it's better to be bored at 150 than, to have Alzheimer's at 80. So if we now have these much longer, kind of productive lifespans, but we've come out of this kind of psychology of saying, it's a good thing to kind of get old, or it's a good thing to die, or something like that. How do we make that adjustment? How do we make that adjustment to where now at 150 years old, we're going to be like, okay, I've got something to do and it's going to matter to me, and I'm going to have, a way to kind of fill my time and find meaning as a human being. What's your take on that?
Well, I think the most important way to think about this is not to think about making an adjustment, but to emphasize the lack of adjustment that will be required. If one is a young adult today, one doesn't really think about how long one has to live as a major, determinant of how one makes one's choices.
Right.
I often, somewhat frivolously, when people ask me that kind of question, I say, okay, take yourself back to the first time you had sex and ask yourself, what were you thinking? In particular, were you thinking, oh my God, I have to get this person to bed right now because I've only got another 60 years to live? No, probably not, right? So, I mean, it's the same deal, really. We, as young adults, we don't think this way. As older adults, we do start to think this way, but that's precisely because we have to, because we know that we don't have all that long. And so, we may get more urgency about getting something done before we become unable to. But the fact is, urgency doesn't only come from a deadline. Urgency comes from, self-esteem and peer pressure and so on. So I believe that we will be psychologically like young adults, just as we are going to be biologically like young adults. And the way that we proceed will, in fact, undergo less change over time as we get chronologically older than it does today.
That's interesting. Yeah. I think about that. The thing you always hear is that, when I was young, I thought I was immortal, or, I thought I would live forever, or something like that. So it seems like you're right that we kind of instinctively at the ages that most people throughout history would have, basically considered their prime, we just don't think about lifespan. We are intuitively kind of living as semi-immortals in a weird sort of way.
I think that's that.
Okay. So, all right. So there's all kinds of obvious other questions that come with this. And I'm sure you've heard a huge gamut of things that go along with that. So some of my listeners, sent in different questions. One of them was just, why would you want to live forever? Mm-hmm. And I might actually want to put another twist on that. And you've kind of addressed it, but what makes you think or feel that life is an unlimited, has unlimited value? I guess maybe that would be a way to say it.
Yeah, okay. So I'll answer both of those questions, because people do ask, certainly the first question a lot, and the second question also quite a bit. The astonishing thing to me is that people are so ready to jump, to make this completely unfounded logical leap from the idea of wanting not to get sick to the idea of wanting to live forever. Hmm. Yes, it's true that this medicine, just like any other medicine, but more so, will have this side effect of giving us a greater than previously expectation of how long we're going to live. Of course, we might be wrong, we might get hit by a supernova or whatever, but the fact is the expectation will increase. But is that why we want to do this? Of course not. Why we want to do this is because we don't want to get Alzheimer's, dummy. It's nothing to do with how long we want to live. The analogy that I often use is like, do you have an opinion about what time you want to go to the toilet next Sunday? Right. You may have an opinion about what time you expect to go to the toilet just because of past records, but what time you want to go to the toilet, of course you don't have an opinion about that. And the reason you don't is because you're going to have better information on the topic nearer the time, and you're going to be able to act on that information. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just breathtaking to me that otherwise smart people will say such inane things, imbecilic things. Now about value. Now that's an important thing again. So that's kind of to my view, it's a kind of highfalutin way of asking the same stupid question. It's like when one talks about the value of life, what does one mean in practical terms? Is it the fulfillment that one gains from enriching other people's lives? Maybe it is. But again, in whatever way we express the value of life, it's not something that is defined by the extent of life, by how long ago we were born, or by how far in the future we expect to die. It's an ongoing thing, so it's dominated by near-term considerations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I have some opinions about this next question. This is kind of what I do, but I want to. I know you've talked to like a lot of different groups and different people, and so I'm curious, what do you see, how might this fit with someone's spiritual pursuits or not fit? Do you think that these two things are kind of in opposition or could work together, or I don't know, how would you contextualize that?
Yeah, I don't think it has the faintest effect on people's spirituality or spiritual thinking. I like to make the comparison with the emergence of the theory of evolution. So some religious people have chosen to reject the theory of evolution, but many other religious people have chosen to explore it and have appreciated that it doesn't in any way undermine the idea that there might be an all-powerful being that is responsible for why we're here and everything. So for me, it's the same kind of thing. This is about alleviating suffering and doing good in this world, and it doesn't undermine spirituality or religion at all. Just putting it in Christian terms, I could say, first of all, in terms of longevity, it may extend our expected longevity, but it doesn't diminish God's power. God, last time I checked, God was supposed to be omnipotent, and so he can perfectly well strike somebody down with a thunderbolt, however healthy they are, right? It's not no change there at all. And furthermore, in Holy Scripture, whether it's Christian Scripture or others, it's perfectly clear that we're not supposed to hasten our own transition to the afterlife. We're supposed to hang around down here doing as much good as we can and minimizing suffering as much as we can, until God calls time on us. And so, to my mind, it's perfectly straightforward. It would be a sin not to work on this, because this is undoubtedly the cause of the most suffering in the world. And, it's perfectly clear again from Holy Scripture that there is no moral distinction between actively causing suffering as opposed to passively causing suffering by inaction. Let's take the parable of the Good Samaritan, for example. It was the person who failed to act who was committing the sin, right? So the case is perfectly open and shut as far as I'm concerned.
That's interesting. I do think you're right to connect the kind of golden rule, and Jesus commands his disciples to heal the sick and feed the poor, and to essentially work against suffering, and in fact connects the idea of judgment to whether one does those things or not. So that's interesting. I also found it interesting that this kind of picture you're painting of people living for kind of radically extended lifespans and even having children at older ages is the kind of thing that we tend to see in scriptural depictions of kind of the ideal life. And that's interesting because it kind of goes against that instinct we have to think that, that our kind of impulse to limitation or to kind of seeing the goodness of death is somehow religious, because it's really not apparent in scriptural text as far as I can see.
Right. I mean, I would call it, a psychologically motivated distortion of what scripture really says. Mm-hmm. It's easy to cling to out of context statements from scripture to say, oh, this means that there is a natural and desirable length of life and we shouldn't try to change that. Well, in fact, if you look at scripture as a whole, it doesn't say that in the slightest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so let's turn to a little bit more practical things. So one person just asked, what's the biggest investment needed to kind of solve the aging problem? Where are, I guess, our most focused efforts needed right now?
Well, of course, Sense Research Foundation is engaged in those efforts, and we are tiny. We have a budget of only around $4 million per year. We spend it very efficiently, and we've made significant strides over the past decade or so. But there's a huge amount that we could have done with more money. And, I don't want to sound as though it's being in any way proprietorial about this, because our goal absolutely is to generate and create a movement, an industry. We've been very successful over the past couple of years in spinning out certain projects into startup companies that are getting their own investment. But that is by no means the way that everything is working. We definitely still have at this point a number of very important components of the whole panel that are still at too early a stage to be spun out, to be investable. And therefore, it's absolutely essential to have a non-profit entity such as Sense Research Foundation as a kind of engine room of the industry to gestate and spawn these individual initiatives in the private sector. So I would say that at this point, it's still the case that by far the best bang for the buck is simply to donate to Sense Research Foundation and let us get on with the job at a more rapid rate. 10 years, 15 years ago, when I first got into this area, I had three problems to solve. I had to figure out a coherent, really coherent plan for defeating aging, and I had to bring the right people, real world leaders in the various scientific disciplines that were relevant to that. I had to bring them on board and get them enthusiastic, and then the third problem was to attract the financial resources to enable them to get on with the job. And it turned out that problems one and two were relatively straightforward, and problem three is still being worked on. We could be going three times faster now if we had maybe 10 times more money.
Yeah, kind of in connection with that. Yeah, so you've got a nonprofit effort here working on this. What is your take on some of the other for-profit efforts that are in a similar space?
So, well, as I mentioned, we have created some of them, but those are the smaller ones. You know, they're at, you know, seed level and Series A level right now. I guess what you're mainly referring to is the much more conspicuous and very large efforts that have come on board over the past couple of years, especially Calico, the company created by Google, and also Human Longevity Inc., which were created by two of the more larger-than-life biotech and visionaries in this space, Peter Diamandis and Craig Venter. Mm-hmm. Both of those companies have a very significant place in this whole universe. They don't, either of them at this point, have as big a place as they could have. Human Longevity started out and are, you know, very explicitly a normal company. You know, they're a company that wants to be profitable reasonably soon. They get investment from a wide range of different investors. They are focused on developing things that can benefit people, even if not very much, at least benefit people quite in the quite short term. So one can really think of Human Longevity as a leading edge personalized medicine company, a company that's trying to use all the best technologies that are around to identify how to optimize the use of the application of today's medicine, of existing medicine, so as to give it the best benefit for each individual. And that's undoubtedly valuable, but it clearly is not the holy grail of the defeat of aging, because it can only optimize things that are fundamentally imperfect. Hmm. Co is in a very different situation. First of all, its budget is essentially unlimited, and so it's not seeking investment from anybody else. And secondly, it has been set up very explicitly to tackle the long-term question of aging, to really bring aging under control. Unfortunately, at this point, Calico is proving to be a massive disappointment. Not because the work it's doing is in some way, you know, short-sighted, but rather that it's too long-sighted. In other words, they are kind of ignoring all of the promise that exists in the research that's already been done, all of the ways in which we might put together current knowledge into new medicines that attack aging more comprehensively than medicines that exist today. The way that they're approaching things is basically to take the view that we just don't have nearly enough initial basic knowledge yet. We need to understand aging much, much better before we can even think about how to apply that understanding therapeutically. Hmm. And I believe that is completely wrong. I believe that it is a point of view based on basically hired the wrong people at the top, having hired especially their chief science officer, David Botstein, who is an emeritus professor from Princeton. Very, very smart guy, no question, but he is a basic scientist through and through. He understands the value of knowledge, and that's pretty much the only thing he understands the value of. So he will never feel that we have enough knowledge. And you don't want someone like that if you want to save lives.
That's interesting. In an interview I was reading with you, you kind of talked about the difference between the science and the technology approach. That you're saying that there is a difference between trying to pursue understanding something and trying to pursue doing something about it.
Absolutely. The difference is huge. And I didn't understand this at all until I started to talk to my wife back in the early 90s about the problem of aging. You know, she was saying, as I mentioned earlier, she was saying that it wasn't interesting, it wasn't very exciting, it wasn't very important. And I was saying, but it kills people. You know, I mean, what the hell? And it was only then that I began to see the profundity of the mindset chasm that exists between basic scientists who want to understand things and technologists who want to manipulate things for human benefit. Hmm. It's just like, and the worst of it is that almost all basic scientists fail to see this chasm. They think that technology is easy and it just kind of falls into place as a kind of, you know, immediate side effect of finding things out. Hmm. And they, you know, they kind of just don't get it.
Hmm. That's interesting. Well, okay. So yeah, the obviously a lot of territory there, a lot of more interesting things that there are to explore, you know, down that road. Obviously, if you're living for hundreds of years, there's all kinds of questions that come up. So, I'll put links to, obviously, the Sense Foundation. Where else should people kind of look to follow your work?
Well, actually, that one link will probably do the trick, because we are pretty thorough on our website with regard to the information we provide, not only about the stuff that we do, but also news reports about stuff that's happening elsewhere. And the material there is very much broad-based. It's direct. The stuff there for anyone, however new you are to the field, as well as, of course, stuff that's much more technically dense. Mm-hmm. So you can find out pretty much everything there. And, of course, there's also a link to send comments and questions. And we're very, very responsive in terms of replying to any queries that we get, whatever it may be about. Okay. Oh, and also there's a nice big friendly donate button.
Yeah, of course. That's great. Okay, well, we'll do that. We'll put links to that in the show note, as well as some of the other things we've talked about. And hopefully we can talk again and explore some other interesting kind of ramifications of this in the future.
I'd be delighted.
All right. Well, thank you, and we'll see you soon.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.